Winter can be an enchanted season, a dreamy romantic time. But not so long ago, it was something to grit our teeth and endure. This hour, we celebrate the return of winter, snow, cold, and everything, from its beauty to the art it inspires, like this piece, to its history. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is Adam Gopnik. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the book we're discussing this hour. It's called Winter, Five Windows on the Season. And we'd love to know what you think is best about winter. What are you most looking forward to as the season turns colder? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Adam Gopnik, so glad you could join us today.
Delighted to be here on first day of winter, Veronica.
Well, here in the northern part of the country, and I know you're a Canadian, so you can relate, winter is greeted with mixed enthusiasm. Some people love it, and other people just endure it. And you're someone who loves it.
I am indeed. You know, I am. I was raised in Canada, though I lived in New York for a long time now. You know, my first experience of winter, my first memory, I had moved to Canada, to Montreal particularly, with my family when I was about 10. And seeing my first snowstorm is still one of the great transformational experiences of my life. I just saw the snow blanketing the world. The whole universe somehow turned from its normal condition into this almost heavenly white wonderland, to use that cliche. And I just loved it, and I've loved it ever since. I love winter sports. I'm a huge hockey fan. And at some deeper level, too, Veronica, you know, apart from my own affection for it, I find it fascinating that here's this season that for centuries, maybe even for millennium, was associated only with misery and mourning, something to get through, has become for so many people in modern times. You were just playing Vivaldi's beautiful winter music, and you could add to that Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker and 100 other great works of music and so many wonderful paintings. Winter has become a great modern subject, and that fascinates me as well.
It has really transformed over the years, hasn't it? I mean, when we think about those earlier winters, and you even have some poetry and other examples about how it used to be just this sort of almost a deadly thing, that it was out to exterminate people in a way. It was an annihilating force, and we've sort of domesticated it, haven't we?
That's exactly right. You know, if you look at mid-18th century poetry about winter, like by the great Dr. Johnson, he has a poem called The Winter Walk, which is about going out for a walk with his girlfriend, and it is the gloomiest, beautifully done, but most depressing thing, and winter is just a symbol for him of barrenness, bleakness. And then suddenly, right around 1800, you begin for the first time to get people writing in a different vein. The wonderful poet William Cowper, spelled C-O-W-P-E-R, who writes this beautiful poem about winter as the bringer of fireside delights and intimate enjoyments. That exactly because winter forces us indoors around the fire with our friends and with our family, it gives us a kind of intimacy that we never have the rest of the year. And that's not just an emotion of, you know, English poets. I think it's something we've all felt, that delight of coming indoors from the cold and feeling secure and loved and intimate. That's certainly a big Canadian emotion. I think it's a general northern emotion. And I think that's what turns us on so much about winter. And it is a modern feeling. And if you think about it, Veronica, what does it depend on? It depends on the existence of central heating.
Right.
If we don't feel safe, then we don't feel secure, and we can't look out our window and love winter. And for all of those centuries, when winter was a real threat to your, not just to your well-being, but to your existence, it's very, very hard to treat it rhapsodically.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, as you say, your book, when you talk about coming in from the cold. As long as you have somewhere to come in from the cold, you can revel in what it was like being out there. And maybe part of it is we get this thrill and we feel a little bit what it was like to go mano a mano with nature, like those early polar explorers did, only that we have the safety of our central heating.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, that one of the reasons, one of the chapters in this book, which I should add was given, I gave in October as a series of lectures, the Massey lectures across Canada. One of the things that I ask in the book is, why do we love tales of polar exploration so much? It's quite weird. You know, polar exploration is not a big chapter in human history. They didn't find gold or diamonds. They didn't find oil. It's not something that produced a lot of goods at all. And yet, people love stories about polar exploration. Every year, there are new books, new documentaries, new poems. Why is that? It's exactly, I think, because we see in the polar explorers a kind of return to that primal confrontation with nature at its hardest. And since we live in a society where, for good or ill, physical courage isn't terribly important, you and I don't do our jobs well or poorly because we're physically courageous, being reminded of how beautiful, how powerful pure physical courage can be, I think that's what leads us again and again back to the stories of Scott and Shackleton and Amundsen and all of those amazing figures who may have been incompetent in lots of ways, but were always brave.
They're great stories, and people love to hear those stories. There have been a number of best-selling books over the past several years. On the other hand, I love the part in your book when you write something like, well, once they got there, what was it for? There was really nothing there. It's as though we needed a test to test ourselves against. But do you want to tell us one or two of these, your favorite polar stories?
Yeah, sure. One of them is the German explorer named Payer, P-A-Y-E-R. And not sure how you pronounce it in German. But he was on one of the German expeditions. And we sometimes tend to forget that in addition to all the English and British and Scandinavian expeditions and American ones, there were Italian polar expeditions and German polar expeditions. Everybody was fighting for national prestige to get to either of the two poles. Anyway, Payer, on this expedition, when they were wintering over, you know, which you had to do in total darkness for a long time, was trying to teach the sailors on the boat, this is in the 1870s, where they were going, what they were headed for, what they would find when they got to the pole. And he had this moment sort of existential revelation where you're like, oh my God, there's nothing there. It's just an empty point on a map. There is no there. It's just an idea that's produced by the existence of longitude and latitude and the fact that the Earth has a top. It's not like climbing to the top of Mount Everest, which is the highest point on Earth. It's just an abstract idea. And he was so sort of startled and shocked by this revelation that he went back, gave up polar exploration, and went to Paris, where he became an extremely successful salon painter, an academic painter, painting these insane sort of Michael Bay scenes of polar disasters, you know, fires on the backs of whales, polar bears attacking, these kinds of gothic grotesque scenes that had never actually happened, but that had a very big audience. I think that's a sign of how we want our imagination of the poles is in a lot of the ways stronger than the reality of it. Another favorite story of mine, though heartbreaking rather than comic, is about how Peary, the explorer who eventually, we think, was the first man to the North Pole, on one of his earlier expeditions was in Greenland. And the Greenland Inuit, we sometimes call the Eskimos, although that's no longer considered correct, had these three iron meteorites fallen from the sky thousands of years before, which they called the Woman, the Dog, and the Tent. And they were their only source for iron. That's where they got all their knives to butcher seals, to do everything they had to do from these three meteorites. And Peary took them from them and brought them back to the American Museum of Natural History. And it was an act of sort of cultural despoilment, of cultural theft, that in one way did no particular damage. By the time there was European contact with the Inuit, they could buy and they could trade for iron. And yet it completely kind of tore the heart out of Greenland Inuit culture. And now you can go across the park from where I live, the American Museum of Natural History, and see these three very unprepossessing-looking meteorites and touch their cool surfaces. And you'd have no idea that they were once the central, sacred, nuclear power plant, shark cathedral things, artifacts of an entire civilization.
Yeah, that is a powerful story. One wonders if they shouldn't somehow be returned at this point, though.
You know, I think that would probably be a good idea, though, if we open the door to, you know, returning cultural plunder. It's a hard door to close, right?
Right, right.
So that it gets complicated. Nor am I entirely sure that the Greenland Inuit want them back so badly. As I say, they're modern people now. They have other sources of iron. But it's, for me, a very powerful image of how things that might not strike us out of context as being sacred or radiant or powerful, once were. And part of what history does for us is to remind us of those lost vibrations.
Well, you have another chapter in your book, which is pretty appropriate to the time of year now, about Christmas.
Yeah.
And Christmas being, at its heart, a winter holiday, but it's also got so many other layers going on in the celebration of Christmas. I wonder if you could sort of unpack this notion of the Christmas celebration for us.
Sure, it's a complicated story. As most people know, there's very little evidence. Effectively, there's no evidence that Jesus of Nazareth was born on December 25th. It was a sort of arbitrary date taken up by the early Christian church, except that it wasn't entirely arbitrary, because there had been a Roman holiday on December 25th before that called the Saturnalia. We still use that term, the Saturnalia, meaning the whole world turned upside down. And it was a holiday where slaves became masters for one day, where every normal part of the moral order was turned upside down, what I call a reversal feast. And the Christians very cannily and intelligently took it up and said, let's take that over as our holiday as well. And so you have in Christmas a sort of a lot of early pagan stuff kind of embedded inside it. There's the holiday of Yule, which comes to us from Northern Europe, which is also an earlier pagan holiday. And what do all these holidays celebrate? They celebrate the disappearance of the sun, the shortest day of the year, and the reappearance of the sun, and our belief that if we light a fire indoors, we light the Yule log, we put electric lights on our Christmas trees, then the sun will return and the cycle of renewal will begin again. Very deep and powerful thing in human beings. And what's beautiful, I think, about modern Christmas is that though we can celebrate it spiritually, if we're believers, we can celebrate it materially, if we're secularists, it still has that kernel of human hope inside it, that by lighting a light, we can relight the sun. And I think that's why it remains so deeply stirring, even for people who don't subscribe to the particular myths and beliefs that it traces.
Well, and you say it's not that hard either to get from Saturn to Santa.
No, it's not. The idea that there'll be a kind of wonderful old man, who's Saturn in the Roman mythology, right? Bearded old man who comes once a year as the Lord of sort of turns everything upside down. So it happens on Christmas, right? It becomes the day when instead of being cautious in our distribution of material goods, we become completely incautious. We just kind of give as much as we can. It's the day when children rule. It's the day when it's the kids' day. It's a holiday meant for children. Always has been. And I think that in that way, exactly, Saturn, the Roman Saturn, is a sort of earlier version of Santa. You know, it's a funny thing. I don't even know if I wrote this in the book. But if you think about Santa, though, originally, of course, he's a saint, St. Nicholas and so on. In the way we think about him now, he's a lot more like a god because he has no particular history. You know, we have 1,000 stories of Santa from the Polar Express to the night before Christmas. But we never hear about Santa's early life, how he ended up at the North Pole, what he's doing there, how he built the factory. He has some of the existence of a minor god for us in the sense that he's just always been there as the god of our abundance. Another interesting aspect of Christmas and Santa, too, Veronica, is that very American holiday. You know, the image of Santa that we all know, the chubby, laughing man with the big white beard, that's an image that the American cartoonist Thomas Nast first produces during the American Civil War. And he produces his Santa very much the kind of deity of the Union cause, that that Santa is the guy who looks after the North, and not the South nearly as much, because he's very much about materialism, very much about abundance, very much about the bourgeois family and all of those things. So that image of Santa is quite modern, dates from the 1860s, and it's very American.
And do you think that's still the prevailing image of Santa?
Yeah, don't you think so? I mean, isn't that the Coca-Cola Santa? Isn't that the Santa we see in holiday cartoons, even in Chris Van Allsburg's Polar Express, where he's a little bit of an industrialist, that big chubby man. Also, he's the spirit of generosity, but he's also the spirit of materialism. He doesn't give us spiritual gifts. He doesn't come and leave little lessons about charity. He comes and gives us toys. He comes and gives us gifts. And that's very much part of what Santa's all about, that there's a connection between materialism, between giving actual stuff, and some form of the spiritual life. You know, that if you think, too, about the other great maker of Christmas, who's the great makers of modern Christmas? Well, the other great one is Charles Dickens, right? We all have seen A Christmas Carol, watched it a million times. We all know that story by heart. And what's the real moral of A Christmas Carol? At the end of A Christmas Carol, Scrooge, who's reformed by the three Christmas spirits, doesn't go to church, He doesn't preach a charity. He gives a big turkey to his employees. And that's what Christmas was all about for Dickens. So I think one of the things that makes modern Christmas so complicated is that it has this very complex relationship between pure materialism, giving gifts, giving turkeys, giving toys, and the way that those acts of generosity can represent a genuine spiritual desire to be charitable, to be generous. And I think that the way that secular material impulses and sacred spiritual impulses are intertwined in the modern Christmas is one of the things that makes it so mesmerizing for us as a holiday.
That's so true. It was interesting to compare Santa with some of the different representations in other cultures. I know, for instance, I think that this is true. This is certainly what I've heard, is that in Finland, instead of having Santa, they have a goat who rides a bicycle.
That's right. Well, even in France, where I had the good fortune to live for many years, Père Noël, as he's called, Father Christmas, is a very skinny guy. You know, he's a thin, gaunt, slightly aesthetic-looking character.
That's so French.
It is very French. And he comes with twigs and toys both. You know, we're talking about the doubleness of that. You're at some risk with Père Noël, right? He can punish you as well as reward you. So some kind of slightly more punitive morality is still there in the French Christmas. I wonder when the last time was that an American kid got coals and sticks and coal for Christmas. I suspect that this happens not at all anymore. We're an easily forgiving and indulgent society.
Our guest this hour is Adam Gopnik. He is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's the author of the book we're talking about today. It's called Winter, Five Windows on the Season. And we're curious to know what you think about winter as we head into the first day of winter now. What are you most looking forward to about winter? Is it Christmas? Is it some aspect of that holiday season? Is it the snow that many of us are still waiting for in Wisconsin? Some of us have it. But is it the snow that excites you? Is it the skating? Is it maybe the hockey, like our guest? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, as we talk with Adam Gopnik about winter on this first day of winter. His book is called Winter, Five Windows on the Season. And here's one of the sounds of winter. It's a piece not on everyone's winter playlist. That is from Winterreise, the song cycle by Franz Schubert, and a story about a winter's journey, some of the art that's been inspired by the season. Adam, do you want to tell us something about this one?
A beautiful work, really kind of masterpiece, unbelievably gloomy, lugubrious music. It's all about a spurned lover who goes out into the winter wilderness, and even the birds throw snowballs at him as he wanders around. It's some of Schubert's most beautiful lyrical music, but it's also immensely sad. It's very much part of a particular moment in this new modern appreciation of winter in Germany, where the melancholy, the scary, the mysterious, all instead of being seen as things that you want to hold at arm's length, are seen as things that are fascinating, sublime, romantic in every sense. And so that instead of being sort of scared of that sadness, you embrace it. So there's a lot of German painting around the same time that takes the bleak winter landscapes of the North and treats them with fascination rather than rejecting them. Says, you know, that's who we are as Northern people. Something Canadians do, something people who live in Minnesota or Wisconsin do as well. We take a certain kind of perverse pride in being winter people. And that's one of the things that's going on in that beautiful Schubert.
Do you think there's something romantic about that notion that, yes, it's bleak and beautiful, but you sort of embrace it and nurture it and cradle that kind of sadness?
Sure. Don't you find that? I mean, I think as a kid growing up in Montreal, I've never known a more beautiful time than about 5 o'clock on a winter evening. You'd be walking off the mountain in Montreal. You'd be walking away from a ski slope at twilight, and there's a kind of piercing beauty about those moments, exactly because it's cold and you're cold. You're not in harmony with nature. You have to struggle to be in some kind of equilibrium even. You put on mittens and wool hats and warm coats, and yet there's a kind of inner satisfaction that comes from that, and that's, I think, very much part of what winter art and music in modern times is about.
Well, let's go to our phone lines now and take our first caller. We have Casey in Port Wing. Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, that's awesome. That was a beautiful song by Mr. Schubert, and your author is talking about growing up in Montreal. Well, I grew up in northwestern Wisconsin on a dairy farm on the shore of Lake Superior.
Hmm.
And the only thing I can remember is how much more work it was when it was wintertime. Pipes freezing, the cow manure frozen stiff like bricks, chipping it off with an axe, trying to get the tractor out of the snowdrift. It was so much work. And as a young person growing up in Bayfield County, the first thing I looked forward to on the first day of winter was it getting over with. Because it was about 10 times as much less work I had to do.
So not very romantic about it.
I don't think the author grew up on a dairy farm in Montreal, did you?
No, I'm a city boy. I'm proudly, unequivocally a city boy.
Yes, yes, but it is a beautiful time of the year, but I'm in Green Bay right now, and the grass is still green, and it's about 40 degrees, so we're not even going to get snow until like the second week of January, they say.
Wow.
So, but anyway, winter's beautiful as long as it's only 3 months long. If it's 6 months long, in Wisconsin we have a motto. There's two seasons. 7 months of winter and 5 months of road repair. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
That's funny. Well, Canadian winter, Montreal winter is like that, too. I can remember as a kid, first day of the baseball season in April, there would still be snow on the field at old Jari Park. You can make snowballs and throw them at the left fielder. So we know long winters, too. Well, I think what your caller just said, Veronica, is significant. It's about something we were talking about before. That is, if your experience of winter is agricultural, is the experience of farmers and peasants as it's been for thousands of years, then it's a tough season, and it really is. And some of the pleasure we take in it does come from, as we were saying, from having a safe indoors. I will add that I know a lot of agricultural people in Vermont and New England and so on who do still take a kind of strong, stoical pleasure in enduring a winter and regard Southerners as slack and weak in comparison.
Well, I will say that I've often felt that I would enjoy winter more if I had an attached heated garage instead of just a driveway. But according to you, maybe that means we're a little too insulated from winter. We can almost ignore it if we've got all the conveniences.
Yeah, you know, that's a complicated story. One of the things that's interesting is that even in winter cities, and there's a whole kind of winter cities movement that connects Montreal and Minneapolis and Helsinki and I'm sure Madison too, tries to talk about how winter can benefit a city. But one of the things we do in winter a lot more and more in modern architecture and urban planning is withdraw from winter into subterranean tunnels, into malls, and so on. And though, you know, I enjoy those things as much as anyone, they do come with a certain sense of loss, that kind of beautiful confrontation we have when we have to look out the window at winter, when we walk down the winter city street, is lost. You know, it's a wonderful bit of sociological research that I really enjoyed when I was researching this book, and that's about how if you study the way people behave in cities in winter, that they have a much more festive attitude. If you look at people waiting at bus stops in Winnipeg, in the summer, they kind of stand stock still beside each other waiting for the bus. In the winter, they sort of beat their breasts and they blow out their smoky breath and they talk to each other and they enact the suffering. They enact the fact of it being winter, and God knows it's cold in Winnipeg. So that people actually seem to act out more on winter streets and winter cities than you'd expect. And if you think about it at all, one of the great sort of modern city inventions is the Christmas window. The Christmas window, you know, we all go, or we all used to at least, to look, even in the cold, from outside at those beautiful animated windows, which began in the 1870s. You know that L. Frank Baum, the guy who wrote The Wizard of Oz, began his professional life as a Christmas window designer.
Huh.
And I think a lot of that sense of the Emerald City, of the unimaginable excitement of an alien place, came out of that experience.
That's interesting. I didn't know that about him. You can see, well, I don't know if the movie reflects that aesthetic, but it certainly seems to.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's go to Margaret, joining us from Rockbridge. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, good morning.
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 It's good to hear you and your voice after reading you for so long.
Nice.
Thank you. Well, for me, I embrace the introspection that winter facilitates, and I love snowshoeing and watching birds and the quality of the air and the challenge of merging and embracing this cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that's a very important point. I've been talking, and I'm in this sort of exuberant mood today because it's one of my favorite days of the year, and Christmas is approaching, all those good things. But it's absolutely true that the kind of, what can we call it, the Buddhist side of winter, the contemplative, introspective side of it, the way that it invites us to kind of turn down our metabolism a little bit and to just take things in. I think that's been a very important element of the modern appreciation of winter. You see it in this beautiful, a lot of beautiful poetry by Elizabeth Bishop, for instance, Randall Jarrell. Wallace Stevens has a beautiful poem called The Snowman, where he says that what you need is a mind for winter, a mind of winter. And what he means by that is a mind that's exactly willing to de-accelerate and take in the world at a contemplative pace, bit by bit. And I do agree with you that that's one of the things that winter offers.
Yeah, it sounds like you're describing that sort of feeling of tunneling in and then maybe emerging something different in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we all use winter as a time of retrenchment and imagined sacrifice, reform. That's where winter thoughts can lead us, and I think it's one of the things that that we also take out of the season.
Thank you for that call, Margaret. And we move next to Randy, joining us from La Crosse. Hey, Randy.
Hi. I want to thank you for a great topic, and guest has got some great insights. I guess I have a comment and then a question. My comment is I found myself being forced to kind of acknowledge the polarization of how I viewed, you know, winter and Christmas as a child, and how we all probably now view it as adults. You know, it's it's a whole lot different experience as an adult. But my question is, going back to Santa Claus, you know, Père Noël, and all the different cultural, you know, beginnings, are you familiar, there was a, I think it might have been Scandinavian, but there was another character who traveled with, I believe, Sinterklaas. Mm-hmm. His name was Krampus, who would... was not a good person to show up at your door. Santa Claus was very good to the kids, but Krampus was more of a devil-like creature who would, you know, he was there to punish the children if they were bad for that year. Is that something you're familiar with?
You know, I will plead total ignorance. No, I didn't know about Krampus, but I think it's true generally that, as we were saying a few moments ago, that in the European sort of Christmas mythology and Christmas rituals, it's true that you can be rewarded on Christmas and you can be punished on Christmas. There's a lot more risk in it. You know, we live in you know, Garrison Keillor's universe where all the children are above average and every kid gets presents or it would damage his self-esteem. So we've kind of gotten rid of the side of Père Noël who carries the sticks or your Grampus who could punish the kids. That's part of the joy and I suppose also part of a certain kind of self-indulgence in American life.
Okay, Randy, thank you so much for your phone call. And as long as we're talking about the holidays, here's an email from Phil who says, I've been told Martin Luther was first to use candlelight on a Christmas tree. What does your guest think?
I have heard that story as well. You know, it's like, it's always very hard to figure out the specific authors of Christmas rituals. Some of them are pretty clear. Thomas Nast really did draw Santa Claus back in the 1860s. But most often that business of lighting candles, trees, blazing logs, light and darkness, all of those kinds of things. So I was saying when we began talking, Veronica, they seem to be as, you know, universal in northern climates, in northern places, as anything that can be. The solstice, the shortest day of the year, has a big effect on human beings. You know, in a trivial way, we talk about, you know, seasonal affective disorder. The darkness is depressing for us, and we want light in its place. But also probably at a kind of deeper spiritual self, the idea that the sun is going out is a fundamentally primal, scary idea for people. And throughout all of, you know, human ritual practice and mythology, the idea of trying to do something to make sure the sun goes back on, stays on, is a very deep one.
Do you think that the sun going out is part of the reason, contributes somehow to the depression that sometimes people feel more keenly at the holidays?
I think that's probably part of it, just at, you know, at a simple physiological level. Darkness, people find depressing. But to be honest with you, Veronica, I think it's probably more social than that. You know, Christmas, the holidays, we tend to overload. I write about this in the book in the chapter on Christmas. We really want it to be a good time. We ask ourselves to do impossible things, like loving all our relatives, things we can't possibly do. We want it to be where we're joyfully propagandized, but still propagandized that it's the most wonderful time of the year, that it's the if every day could be like Christmas. And the reality is our lives are much more ambiguous than that. Our emotions are much more ambivalent than that. And so enormous anxiety gets generated by the holidays, I think, Christmas and Hanukkah and all the others, because we want so much to take nothing but pleasure in them. And it's very hard to take nothing but pleasure in anything.
Hmm.
And I think that that is one of the reasons why, tragically, suicides tend to peak at the holidays. There are times of when we're as aware of our loneliness as perhaps as we're able to revel in our solidarity in our community.
This is probably completely off base, but I do think it's interesting, and this has happened before, but the cluster of high-profile deaths that tend to happen around the holidays,
yeah,
I often wonder about.
I think, you know, one of the things that certainly seems to be true is that people will themselves to live to a certain point, have that ability to a birthday or to the end of the year, and maybe that's part of it.
Well, another phone call. Leslie is next from Preston. Hello, Leslie.
Hi. You guys are talking about the depressing part of winter, but I think people should embrace it. I'm so glad I had a mom and dad who booted us kids out all the time because there were seven of us to go outside and play, and we all had so much fun in winter. We skated all the time at a skating rink near us. We built all kinds of stuff in the snow, and we were outside in it every day, no matter what. Even if it was too cold to go to school, we still went outside. And even today, especially with all the clothes they make for winter, there's no reason why and lights that you can, headlamps or whatever, you can go out anytime and enjoy it. When I go out and feed the horses at night, that's my favorite time in the winter. When I always bundle up and am plenty warm, but the horses, you can see their breath, and it's so peaceful outside. I don't want to come back in. And then when I get in the house, it's way too hot. I can't wait to get. It's way too hot inside. So I don't know. I the year that it snows a lot, and I can just leave my cross country skis down my deck. Winter goes way too fast. If you get out and enjoy and look forward to winter, it goes too fast.
What is your favorite thing to do in the winter? Is it skiing?
Mine?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know. I think just being outside, just going out. I hike, we snowshoe, cross-country ski, we snowmobile.
You do it all, it sounds like.
I just love, I love summer too, but I love winter. Because if you can bundle up, it's like a free day. If you go out and just, it doesn't have to be for all day. I mean, just go out for an hour or a half an hour, and you come back in and you feel great, and then you can sit and read a book and not feel guilty about just sitting there. But, yeah, embrace it. Go for it.
All right. Thanks, Leslie.
I am certainly with you about that. I love ice skating. I'm a horrible ice skater. Probably, you know, Canadian boys are supposed to be good on skates, and I am about as bad as you can be. But I love doing it anyway. And I think that one of the things, you know, we've been talking about how winter pleasures tend to divide between the active and the contemplative. One of the things that's a joy for me about ice skating is that it has a little bit of both. You know, you have to work with friends to clear off the pond or travel to the rink, and getting your skates on is a big deal, and getting all ready to go skating. It's not like jogging where you just start moving your legs. And you're with a lot of other people typically when you're skating. And yet, everywhere I've ever been skating, you can find a space for yourself, a little bit of solitude on the ice very, very quickly. And finally, skating is a very solitary, beautifully solitary act. And so that very winter kind of rhythm between the active and the communal and the solitary and the contemplative, for me, that's present every time I put skates on and go out to skate. And I can't think of a summer pleasure that quite equals that, that quite mirrors that particular kind of sense of beautiful loneliness.
Hmm. Are you going to go skating today to celebrate the first day of winter?
It's not. I wish I could. It's drizzling, damn it, here in New York City. One of the miseries of my life is that though I love New York in many ways, New York does not have a good winter. We have sort of 4 months of gray when it stays in the 40s, so it's never quite cold enough or not usually cold enough to skate, and there's never enough snow to ski. So we just have to endure the permanent grayness of a big concrete and asphalt city.
Well, we've got a drizzly day here as well, at least in Madison we do. So hoping it'll get a little bit chillier so we can enjoy this first day of winter. Well, we're talking with Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's the author of Winter, Five Windows on the Season. And we'd love to hear your questions and comments about winter. What is it that you love best and are most excited about for this coming season? Or maybe what are you most dreading about getting through the winter? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. And this hour we're discussing winter with our guest Adam Gopnik. And here's a piece called Snow is Dancing to Celebrate Winter. And we haven't talked explicitly about snow yet, but snow is obviously one of the attendant joys of winter, unless, of course, it's a misery. But one thing that we often hear is this old chestnut that no two snowflakes are alike. How true is that?
Complicated story. Turns out not really to be quite so. There's a wonderful character. I say someplace in the book that he would have been the hero of the best movie Frank Capra never got to make. Real Jimmy Stewart character. A guy named Snowflake Bentley. Lived in Vermont at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And he was the guy who invented microscopic photography of snowflakes. He found a way, starting when he was a teenager, to take snowflakes out in the cold, put them against a kind of black velvet-like background, and take photographs of them. And, you know, all of the images we have of snowflakes in our mind, those beautiful sort of crystalline flowers, the kind that, you know, are reproduced and you hang them above the crossroads of a town and so on, those are his. Those are the photographs that Snowflake Bentley took. But here's the funny part. First funny part about it is that he did an awful lot of editing. It turns out that those kinds of perfectly symmetrical, beautiful sort of cut-out snowflakes are as rare as can be. Great majority of snowflakes look like modern art. You know, they're totally asymmetrical. They're kind of awkward, galumphing, surprisingly sort of columnar forms. So those are the kind of like the supermodel snowflakes, right? There's one in a million that looks like that. And the other funny thing is that he was also the guy who put the idea in the world's imagination that no two snowflakes were alike, because as he was doing these photographs, the snowflakes that he found were all different. And that became a very powerful metaphor. We still use it for individuality, how none of us are exactly alike anyone else. But just a few years ago, just about a decade ago, a meteorologist in Wisconsin, in Madison, if I remember correctly, took a plane up into a snow cloud and looked at what snowflakes were like, snow crystals is what they're technically called, what snow crystals were like in sort of their pristine form in the clouds. And damn it, they're all exactly alike. They're all in their first appearance. They're all very, very similar.
And this is when they're what, way up above the clouds?
Way up above us in the cloud, when they're first forming in clouds. And it's as they fall through all the accidents of air currents and winter wind that they take on their particular crystalline shape. So that by the time they get to Earth, they really are different. But in their first appearance, they're all alike. And I think that that's a wonderful new metaphor, a lovely poetic metaphor for all of us of what individuality is like. You know, we start off remarkably similar, and then the currents of our existence, the winter winds of life, alter us, and we reach the Earth, we mature all differently, and then, as I add in the book, then we all melt.
Well, that's a beautiful way to think about it, too. I can take that in exange for every snowflake being different.
Yeah, I like the notion. I prefer the notion that snowflakes start off the same, and then are, so to speak, shaped and educated into difference from the notion that they're all born different.
They are pretty amazingly beautiful when you get a look at one. Occasionally one will just drift down to the car window and you can study it as it sits there, and they are just these mini wonder worlds just to explore a snowflake.
Heart-stoppingly beautiful, I've always found. And you know, just to add one more little cultural note, a little bit of history to this, back in the 19th century, around the time when Schubert was writing that wonderful music, a lot of German scientists and poets had a very fierce, weird debate about whether snowflakes were, and ice crystals generally, were organic, whether they were like flowers, or whether they were like rocks, whether they were just sort of accidents of geology. It's a weird thing to debate,
yeah.
but they did, because it involved questions about theology. You know, could you see the hand of God even in snowflakes, or were they just accidents of crystal formation? Very funny kind of debate to fill people's minds.
Another caller now. Let's go to Sean with us from Burlington. Hello, Sean.
Hi. Well, today's my birthday. I was born at 5 minutes to midnight.
Just happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I love winter. I always have the memories of sledding and all the winter sports. I've always done all of them. And we like to go sledding down our driveway. And by the way, I still have the flexible flyer sled that I got when I was about six. And that is the best sled in the world. And my son covets it.
Flexible flyer, huh?
Yeah, and I like to cut paths out in the snow and play tag with the dogs and go out at night into the whiteness. And a couple years ago when my son pulled the pull cord out of my snowblower and I had to shovel in one of the snowiest Decembers we've ever had, rather than grumble about it, you get lots of time with your own thoughts, and I got a song out of it. So I just enjoy being out in the weather.
You're a songwriter?
Yes.
That's wonderful. There's so much great winter music and winter songs. We were just listening to Debussy's lovely piece, The Snow is Dancing. You know, one of the things that fascinates me about winter music, is particularly about Christmas music, is that Christmas carols come to us from such different times. You know, it was only back in the 19th century that people first started putting together books of Christmas carols as though they were a distinctive kind of music. And one of the things that's fascinating about them is some of our favorite Christmas carols, like Lowly My Liking, let's say, or Greensleeves, and What Child Is This, go all the way back to medieval times. And yet some others, like In the Bleak Midwinter, for instance, are very modern. They were made at the end of the 19th century, and yet they all kind of get mixed up into one sort of beautiful playlist where we don't distinguish very much between the medieval and the modern. I find that very moving.
Yeah, that is. Do you have a favorite carol?
Do I?
Uh-huh.
Yes, absolutely. In the Bleak Midwinter, I think, is the most beautiful song ever written, probably. It's, you know, the words are by Christina Rossetti, English poet, and music's by Gustav Holst, you know, the same guy who wrote
The Planets.
But for me, that sums up the beauty of winter. It sums up some of the kind of heartbreak of Christmas, the idea of that we are in the bleak midwinter, but that a light will shine again. And whether you're a believer or a non-believer, I think that kind of imagery is immensely poignant and powerful.
Yeah, that is an exceptionally beautiful one, isn't it? It's
yep.
kind of hard to date it when you hear it. You can't really tell when it's from.
Exactly. When you hear it, you think, that's so beautiful. It could be, you know, 1200, or it could be, 2100. It's so simple and so beautiful. But it's actually English late 19th century.
Well, thank you much for that call. And we turn next to Sharon, who's with us from Appleton. Hi, Sharon.
Thank you for this show.
You're welcome.
We're a fan. We have a few of Snowflake Bentley's books here. My kids loved them when they were little, especially. But I'm from Buffalo, New York, and I have to say I love snow. And for me, it's a time of I do a lot of baking, like bread baking in the winter, and it just walking in from a cold snow with the kids sledding and the hot cocoa and the fresh bread is just a big part of winter for me. But really what I called to say is what I had heard and always understood about the origins of Santa Claus were St. Nick, and I'm not from here, from Wisconsin, but when I moved to Appleton, my oldest son, who was about 5, I guess, at the time, came home from kindergarten and said, Mom, and this is December 6th, said, Mom, all St. Nick came last night and all the kids got a gift. And so when I, of course, I didn't know anything about it, and so I was didn't have anything for him at the time, and then found out more that St. Nick is really celebrated here early December in this community, in this in greater part of the city, and kids leave their shoe in front of the fireplace. And as I learned more about it, luckily I found a little gift for him and explained to him that it was a zip code, that St. Nick was using zip codes now because there's so many people now, he had to do them over a few nights, but my kindergartner accepted that, but that, and then I remember, and then I learned after that he was a German bishop who left a dowry in a girl's shoe whose family didn't have enough money to, pay for her wedding, and he left a dowry of gold coins in her shoe, and those little foil-wrapped chocolate gold coins sometimes, you know, gets passed out on St. Nick's Day around here anyway, or at least it did at churches and things to celebrate that early Santa Claus, so...
Uh-huh. Sharon, do you have snow up there in Appleton yet?
No. And my kids are snowboarders and hockey players, and so we're missing it, but hopefully
yeah.
pretty soon. I guess warm up before Christmas, though, so I don't think
so. You know, this is true right through the northern region. I know there's no snow, believe it or not, in Montreal yet this year, or only a very minor coating, and usually Montreal is under 6 feet of snow by December 21st. I'm exaggerating, but essentially so. So we seem to be it seems to be a kind of dry winter. Fascinating about Santa Claus. Yeah, and the truth is there's all kinds of mythology about St. Nicholas and so on and where he comes from, and that predates the American Santa Claus. And the point I was making before was that the image of Santa Claus we have is that wonderfully corpulent, generous, laughing guy. You can find it in the poem, you know, A Visit from St. Nick, which of course we all know. But the visual image of it, the department store Santa Claus that we take our kids to and put on his lap, that's very much Thomas Nast, the great cartoonist's invention.
All right. Well, Sharon, thank you so much for that phone call. And another phone call here from Jolena in the UP in Michigan. Hi, Jolena.
Hi. I just wanted to share what we do in our... I'm from Croatia, first of all. And we celebrate Christmas, but we celebrate with Dia de Mraz, which means Grandfather Frost. But we do have a very heavy Catholic background, so most of our celebrations are based on the spiritual rather than the, you know, the material. It also includes one day that all children absolutely dread, and that happens 3 days after Christmas on the 28th, when, according to stories, you know, Herod, the story of the children that were massacred, parents will actually wake their children up to a severe spanking and repeat the same phrase over and over again, which is grow up, because, you know, all the children that were were under the age of 2. And then after this, you know, this terrible moment, as you're standing there crying, your parents are handing you candy and gifts and things like that because you are their child, which I thought was amusing when I think back, you know, when you were saying about how in America people do give gifts because they don't want to hurt a child's self-esteem and things like that by getting coal. And here, you know, 3 days after Christmas, we're having this really a terrible celebration.
Where was this? I'm sorry, I missed a beat. Where did this take place?
I'm from Croatia.
Uh-huh.
Well, the region of Bosnia. I'm Croatian by nationality. Sure. But that's a very big custom. And we also have our own Mother's Day and Father's Day during the holidays right now.
Well, I know we should be tolerant of other people's customs, but that strikes me as sick. I mean, I think that, we overindulge kids, it's true, and that's, you know, one of our features, but hitting kids, I think, is something that there's never an excuse for. So I'm against that particular Christmas ritual.
I think we may have time for one last brief phone call. Let's go to Vivian quickly in Milwaukee. Hi, Vivian.
Hi. Please, I have the idea that all this promotion of isn't New England beautiful was kind of a winter coming back against Hollywood, where everything is summery or not.
Palm trees.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's probably some truth in that. That is that we, you know, we react against the, whatever is the dominant thing. If everybody's praising palm trees in the tropics, then we say, well, nothing's so bad about winter. Probably something in that. You know, the thing is, you know, in all the talking we've been doing, Veronica, about it, you know, I think that the choice isn't so much whether we love winter or hate it. The truth is that our reaction to it is bound to be ambivalent, just like our reaction to so many things in the world is ambivalent. We love the cold and skating and skiing and the exhilaration of it and the intimacy of indoors in winter, as all the callers have been describing, and we're also exhausted by its difficulties and its unpleasantness, as other callers have described. But exactly what I think fascinates us is that it gives us something to have mixed emotions about, and mixed emotions is sort of key to being a grown-up modern person.
And we have to leave it there. We're out of time, but Adam Gopnik, happy winter to you.
Happy winter with no mixed emotions at all.
All right, Adam Gopnik.
Take care. Thanks.
The author of Winter, Five Windows on the Season. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network.